All right, episode 2. If you're new here, I don't know. Hey, welcome. But also, go back, listen to the first episode. It's good, I promise. Here's where we left things. The Australian songwriter Ben Lee is locked down in hotel quarantine in Sydney for 2 weeks. And he and I, Max Quinn, hello, we're going to talk for half an hour every day. I want to cover all the bases that make Ben, in my opinion, one of Australia's most compelling and most curious communicators, inside and outside of songwriting. In episode 1, we covered a lot of ground. Quarantine, creativity, activism. Today, I'm ready to talk about QAnon. It's the conspiracy hoax that Ben has been rallying against online. Weird sentence. How does a celebrated Australian songwriter take up the cause of fighting the political far right? Let's find out. Hi, Ben.
Hey, mate.
Where are you today?
Same place, oddly enough. So what a coincidence.
How are you finding it?
Today, good. Today was a bit like, I think for my daughter, the youngest one, I think it sort of hit her that she had to kind of play by herself more than she's used to, because she's like me. Yeah. She's like a people person. And she was like, I can't think of anything to play. And she got really angry at us for not coming up with good ideas.
How often are you told that you don't have good ideas?
A fair amount. But it's funny because it comes with this immense pressure to have good ideas.
Oh, yeah.
So I say, like, in a way it's a good criticism because it speaks to a track record of decent ideas. but it's still hurtful.
Yeah, okay, good. How do you reconcile that with her?
I don't know if I was great. I mean, I just kind of think with ideas, spend enough time without one and you'll have one. So I was not that. I sort of like to entertain. I'm a little bit like, I really like the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is like, meditate on your mortality and worms eating your flesh. And like, in some ways, the limitation can be quite liberating.
Sure.
So she was like, I just can't think of anything I want to play. And I was like, well, maybe you don't want to play. And she was like, right. No, I do want to play. That's not the point. And I was like, well, maybe you don't. Doesn't sound like you do. I mean, you know, I'm just sort of trying to like, ultimately she figured it out on her own. And I think that's sort of what I was hoping for, I guess.
I always remember this conversation I have with my friend Cal Bailey a long time ago. And Cal was like, the greatest value that you can have as a child is sitting in the back seat of the car and being bored. And I was like, that's not wrong.
I think it's true, but I also think it is a classic kind of old people way of thinking about reality in that you could argue that in a way for a kid looking at an empty like TikTok opportunity, like a chance to make something where there's nothing there before, that is a blank canvas. And
right.
There's no way to avoid, unless you are essentially like a cog in a machine where you have the type of job where someone just tells you what to do and you do it, there's no way to avoid having to be creative and come up with ideas regardless of the paradigms shifting and, you know, as they have.
Yeah, it's problem solving in whatever space you were in. And I saw you post today to Instagram about a problem that you solved because you were having shaker struggles.
Yeah, well, I got an opportunity to pitch a song for a kids show that Apple TV are making. And
cool.
And it all happened the day I was leaving LA. And so I knew I'd have my studio set up, but literally like very jet lagged and with whatever I had, I had to pull this song together and submit this demo. And yeah, I realized I didn't bring any percussion. And so traditionally you use salt and pepper, but I didn't even have salt and pepper. So I used a prescription medication that like
a little
shaking it along like that. Yeah. I mean, this is punk rock. I mean, punk rock is about what DIY, what do you have and what can you do with it?
What can you make out of it?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. That is life theory for me as well as a music theory. I have been thinking kind of along those lines. Like we made something yesterday and
yeah, how'd you feel about it?
I felt good.
Okay,
yeah,
good. Me too.
I felt like that. Thank you. That's cool. It's good to know.
Yeah.
There were some things that I percolated on and some stuff that I want to follow up on, some loose threads that I want to tug at, because for me, I was the big thing, and we'll get to like there's songwriting and there's so much stuff that I want to come to with you. But you mentioned yesterday that you had been on a call with all of these activists and like a Republican voice standing up against Trump. How did that happen?
Yeah, activism is something that, you know, it's to some degree I've always been somewhat involved in it. Like Noise Addict, my first band, we had a song called Meat that was like my 13-year-old attempt to write about vegetarianism.
You like baby propaganda.
Climate change. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, whenever opportunities came up, whether it was like going to Garma, do you know about the Garma Festival in Arnhem Land?
Now, yes, I do know about that.
Yeah,
yes.
It's beautiful, beautiful sort of tribal council in a sense that you have to be invited to. And I was always take opportunities, but I also felt, you know, my dad was in local politics.
Right.
And I grew up quite cynical about politics, but not just that, felt like I just felt, particularly being an Australian living in America, not as a citizen, I felt disempowered politically in both Australia and America.
Okay.
And I felt that my voice was not only not particularly useful, but also presumptuous to think that I had something to contribute. And as much as I was troubled the last 4 years by Trump and, you know, my politics were very much, you know, left-leaning, I still felt, who am I to say, speak up or get involved? I mean, I think a lot of people feel that, let alone if you're an immigrant to a country, you know,
sure,
where there's no shortage of voice of loud voices also, you know. I had a moment, Black Lives Matter, I was like really moved by. When I first went to America when I was a little kid, I loved Spike Lee. When he was like my first sort of, in a way, like the first director who I even understood there was a director in movies. You know what I mean? Like there's a point where you suddenly go like, oh, there's a director. There's someone making it. There's a vision here.
And his universe connects in this way. And
yeah. And that he also had an agenda beyond film, that he had a point he wanted to make, or questions he wanted to ask, or conversations he wanted to start. And a lot of those were about race. And I was really moved by it. I remember being 10 years old and going to LA with my parents and, going to his store, which was 40 Acres and a Mule, which is, you know, where that's his production company. And that comes from what supposedly, you know, freed slaves were meant to have been given contractually at the end of their, slavery. Not everyone got it, but that was, anyway, you know, when I was a kid, I loved rap, and into my 20s, like I loved Jay-Z, and like Black culture to me in America felt like one of the things that was like keeping it vibrant. The conversation about racism, you know, when I was growing up, it was more about Asian immigrants and things like that, like Romper Stomper, and you know, like the ways it was a different thing. But I found that the force of the conversation from when I was a little kid in America, I found it very engrossing and very dynamic. And as I grew up and you know, had Black friends and understood what, you know, this was like a real human issue, an ongoing issue that you can't run away from it in America. It's in your face, you know? And I felt I liked that. And when Black Lives Matter came up, I started having conversations with people that were conversations that I'd never had the opportunity to have. I have this friend and collaborator named Shamir. Do you know him?
I do. Yeah. Shamir rules.
Yeah, Shamir's amazing. So me and Shamir had been collaborating earlier in the year. And when Black Lives Matter, when everything was happening and the protests got really big, it was a couple weeks into it, I was like, whoa, I should check in with how Shamir's doing. Like,
right.
And I just texted him. I was like, hey, man, are you doing okay with everything? I just wanted to say hi. And he said, yeah, absolutely. Thanks for checking in. But then later I was on Twitter and I saw that he retweeted someone saying, hey, when you check in on one of your few Black friends, you should ask yourself, is it more for you or for them? And I was like, I was like, oh no, did I just do like a really intentional, basically racist faux pas? And
sure.
And I screenshot the tweet and I sent it to him. I was like, hey man, if I messed up, I'm really sorry. And he said, that wasn't directed to you at all. We've been getting closer and we are, you know, we're friends. He's like, that was directed to, I've actually been reached out to by a lot of like people that were not nice to me in high school and people that actually like distanced themselves from me that now are trying to like have some connection to me because I'm the black person they know. And anyway, the point was we had this conversation and it was a fascinating conversation that we would never have had. Like me and Shamir exclusively have talked about music and culture and like pop culture. His blackness and my whiteness had never entered the conversation. And suddenly there it was. And we were talking about it as two musicians. Anyway, that all happened. And I was so moved by Black Lives Matter. And I just felt it was such a like, it was so funny because it was such a no-brainer to me. It was undeniable. Black Lives Matter. What's to argue with, right?
But there
was, what happened was Trump, you know, sent in the National Guard. And I still get choked up thinking about it because, yes, there were those protests. There were both instigators that were not part of BLM that were sent in to disrupt. And there was also disruptive elements that happens in any time you gather thousands and thousands of people together, you get a disruptive element. Look at any footy game for that, you know, the audience for that type of thing. So
go to a gig.
Exactly. Go to a gig, go to Big Day Out, you know, whatever. It's all. Yeah. So I just, when I saw literally there was like tanks in the street on Hollywood Boulevard, 10 minutes from our house. And I thought, this is his response.
Mm.
And there was a large segment of the population he is supposed to be representing saying, we're in pain. We don't feel counted. We don't feel heard. We don't feel listened to.
Help us.
Help us. Listen to us. He should have said, talk to me.
Yeah.
He should have said, I want to know.
And so is that the catalyst for you? Like, is that the point at which you were like, okay, cool. Well, I can see the response and now it's on me to raise my voice.
It was visceral. It was like I got on Twitter and I said, I'm sorry. This crossed the line. And maybe it should have been the kids in cages. Maybe it should have been the Muslim ban. I mean, these were all things I was passionate about, but not to the point of going, I'm going to work right now, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And that moment I was like, I'm going to work. I am bringing this guy down. And I saw Thurston Moore from Sonic Youth.
Yeah.
He said something that it was like, yes, man, you said it. He said, this was never about Biden versus Trump. This was me versus Trump. And I was like, yes, that's exactly it. And from that moment, I mean, that happened in, I forget when it was now, was it May or April or something? But
that's
basically
right.
From that point until the election, I basically dedicated almost all my time to me and my wife both to working on getting Trump out of office because I just felt like this crossed the line that as like as someone that has kids and will hopefully have grandkids and will be an elder one day, when you ask me what I did, I am not going to say I did nothing. And that was really what tipped it for me.
Right, and you wanted to contribute in a big and public way and use the platform that you have. I want to revisit a couple of things from there. So you were talking about Shamir and your relationship and how, you know, you being a white man and him being a black person had never come up. Does it come up in the subtext, do you think? Does it come up in the way that you interact as human beings, understanding that the life that he has led to get him to his point is inherently different to the way that you have led your life to get you to that point?
Well, yeah, of course, but that's the thing about subtext, that you can ignore it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what I've learned certainly about privilege is that it's there all the time.
Right.
The people who don't think about it are the people who are privileged.
Right.
So for me, easily I've ignored that stuff in my life, but sometimes historical moments come up where you can't ignore it anymore.
Right. And so this historical moment is an awakening of dormant privilege for you in a sense, you know? Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, I would. I don't feel any issue with that. I just find the sensitivity around the idea of privilege to be absurd.
It's silly, isn't it?
The idea that I, as a 14-year-old, was able to get a record deal and play, I could barely play an instrument.
Right.
I mean, I think even to white people, I seemed privileged. You know what I mean? Like, I was a punk, man. I got lucky.
Yeah.
And I think that had a lot to do with my whiteness, my middle class, my, you know, like the fact that I sort of grew up thinking that there was possibility for me and that that wasn't absurd. Whereas
yeah.
It was absurd. And I perhaps, I don't know, it ties into what we were talking about yesterday, about the type of insanity you kind of have to have as a creative person.
Sure, the absolute
because
ego.
It's really weird.
Yeah.
To have done what I did and to do what any creative person does. But a lot of it is also a function of privilege.
Yeah, like I think about my own life and my journey and thinking when I was a teenager, yeah, I could probably work at the radio. And then going and doing it and, you know, all these years later being like, oh shit, I operated with a great deal of privilege in being able to, you know, have the opportunities to be able to put myself in a position to rah, 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 rah. What I'm saying is, I wonder where along the line that changes for more and more people as we move deeper and deeper down this hole that you have been pursuant of in the last 6 months, which is QAnon, essentially. Is that a fair thing to say? Like, you've spent a lot of time down the rabbit hole of QAnon.
Yeah. It is connected. There was a portion of my wider community who, in the face of crisis and struggle to do with COVID in the US, to do with Black Lives Matter, assumed a position that I was perplexed by.
What was that?
Well, the position they took in response to, for instance, wearing masks was, you can't tell me what to do.
Yeah.
That was one. And the other was a complete silence on Black Lives Matter. And I noticed it. I noticed it. And it became a sort of project of mine trying to understand how sort of like left-leaning, kind of progressive hippie type people seemed to be moving in a completely other direction than the one I remained in, which
right.
was a commitment to social justice and, you know, inequality and ending climate change. And, you know, it seemed obvious to me where I stood. They seem to be going off in another direction.
Well, it seems like there's a cognitive dissonance there, right? Like in between this idea of like hippie, progressive thinking about, you know, existence and how we fit into it and abject silence. It seems like those two things shouldn't go hand in hand.
Well, clearly it was speaking volumes in its silence.
Mm.
And what I came to realize was that in some ways, what happened with COVID and the quarantining and shutting down of America became this sort of archetypal confrontation with our most hidden selves. And for some of us, it turned into like, I mean, in a way, I should try not to be judgmental. I think for many people, it turned into a commitment to be part of change.
Right.
And realizing that now, whichever side you were on, that you were going to go deeper into like committing to change. But a lot of it was because people were spending so much time on their phones. And the nature of social media and the way that the social media game is being played intentionally, I've come to realize, by some very heavy agendas, affected the way people I knew were hyperlinking around, the kind of information that they were consuming, whether it was about COVID deaths. You know, like the first person I knew, Adam Schlesinger from Fountains of Wayne, to die of COVID.
That
amazing.
I have chills thinking about, let me real quick.
Please.
The day that he died, I was playing to my fiance this song that he wrote. Do you know the song that he wrote for Sesame Street that Ernie sings called I Wonder?
No, I should check it out.
You should check it out. It's really beautiful. He's basically asking all these mystical questions of the universe. It's got this beautiful change towards the back end where he's asking about why the lightning always comes before the thunder and like it's, I don't know, some inverted chord with the third in the bass and like the whole thing is just like swelling and beautiful and why does the bumblebee fly, buzz like it does or something, whatever it is. And we're sitting there, and as this bumblebee line is happening, I shit you not, into our window and into our bedroom for about 4 seconds flies this big, beautiful bee that I've never felt spirituality in my entire life, Ben. But for those 10 seconds, and we both saw it, and we both looked at each other, and we went, is that real? Could that be something that actually genuinely happens? Because I just have learned everything that I know about music through listening to that man in particular and the way that he constructs his songs. And it's, you know, fascinating and impactful. And even for you and I to be having this conversation now, that it has come out quite organically of this conversation that, you know, he's the first person that you knew that passed from COVID as well, is, it's impactful for me. And I want to acknowledge it as it's happening.
Well, I think he touched a lot of people. Did you hear the tribute album that came out a little while ago?
So
a bunch of artists and friends of his, we all did songs, and me and Sarah Silverman did a duet of a song he did called Way Back Into Love. But because he died, I knew someone who died in the early days of COVID.
Right.
It was very real. Also, my wife's cousin had COVID, was in the hospital, almost died, and her uncle got out. I was like, there was no question. I just was like, oh yeah, this thing it's happening. This other agenda that came up of people questioning whether it was existing at all, I was just sort of like, what, how is this happening? And what I realized is that in the journey I took since then is that the current war that's being fought in the world right now is a war of ideas. It's not a war that's happening on a traditional battlefield. It's not even an economic war. It's not about trade. It's a war of ideas, of ideology. It's happening on Twitter. It's also happening at people's like Christmas dinners. You know, it's a war of concepts. And I think what people realized is that like securing finances and political power and trade and all of that is actually easy once you win the war of ideas, because then you can like, you know, you get the votes, you get, you know, you stack the cabinet, you get the policies in the right way. It's like, it all begins with ideologies and, you know, and the, so what I've sort of learned since then is, do you know what a PSYOP is?
No.
So a PSYOP is a psychological operation.
Okay.
And this isn't a new idea. Like the CIA and, intelligence agencies around the world have been involved in PSYOPs forever. That's how, you know, the war against communism was on both sides. There was psychological operations of essentially propaganda to try and win a war of ideas, you know?
Right.
But what I realized is that a lot of the information that people I knew were consuming that was essentially radicalizing them to distrust health departments, mistrusting the agenda of something like Black Lives Matter. There was a constant feed of content coming to people on their phones once they had, you know, that now we know we call it being red-pilled, once that they had taken those first steps into these kind of conspiracy theory, alt-right.
You're too curious.
Yeah, COVID denialism, whatever. You know, like you click a few links and you are going to be fed a stream of information. And it's also going to basically empower you, which is what all cults do, to make you feel like you are on the inside of a secret process that not everyone has access to.
Yeah.
And basically, because I've been involved in spiritual communities or cults before, I watched this happening to people and I recognized it. And I also saw the emotional, like, I mean, we've already been talking for half an hour, but the one of the really interesting things is why does QAnon and why do these conspiracy theories harp on about pedophilia and sexual abuse as much as they do?
Right. What's the answer?
There's a very specific reason for it, because people have been so traumatized by sexual abuse in general, that it's easy to re-traumatize them through having them sit for hours a day reading about pedophilia and sexual abuse, and then empower them to solve it by offering them a solution to why it's occurring.
Okay.
So basically, it's a psychological tool. It's a tool of manipulation that what you basically realize is that indoctrination and radicalization always involves re-traumatization of the mark. And I would say anyone that's clicking on these links is essentially a mark. There's someone who is open and receptive to this psychological operation. And the deeper I started looking into it, because you kind of go like, well, what's the end game? Obviously, there's a whole cast of characters involved in QAnon, but what is the agenda? Is there one agenda? And it's not necessarily, they're not all interested in securing or solidifying political power for Donald Trump. But I think there is a deeper fundamental, like a core issue here, which has to do with that the radicalization through QAnon is designed to turn people against democracy.
Well, I just want to get my head around that. So idea is that the way that the QAnon system, we'll call it system, operates is to profiteer on fear and trauma in order to make these comments about democracy, in order to demonize democracy.
Yeah, it's to distrust. It's like, look at fake news. That's a really that's a really easy way of thinking about it. Mm-hmm. You basically now have a large population in the world that believes that there is no objective truth. Yep. Talk about a world of ideas, a war of ideas here. I mean, this is a profound conceptual argument to have. Is there objective truth or is there not? We used to talk about this like when we were stoned and 16 and like you pick up a flower and go, how do I know that the yellow I'm seeing on the flower is the same yellow you're seeing?
Yeah, right? I've had like, that conversation. Because,
yeah, like you trip out on it. But what does that do when you undermine the idea that the media could have any truth in it or that an election could be legitimate? You basically completely you've undermined an entire trust in participation in a democratic system.
Yeah.
And from that point, once people distrust, they don't believe there's any objective truth. They distrust all systems. They distrust all authority. They distrust all media voices coming at them. From that point on, they're actually it's so ironic because you've made them supposedly cynical, but they're incredibly easy to manipulate.
And incredibly loyal to Q.
And which says a million different things and contradicts itself over and over again. But the point is, that is how you break people's spirit. You radicalize them. They give up all of their power and all of their autonomy, and they're yours. That's the way cults work.
Right. It feels en masse culty.
Yeah, but what's weird about it is, and this is like another layer to it, that at the moment, QAnon is sort of turning on the Republicans.
Yeah, Have you been seeing that? So basically, I've spent like 36 hours down the wormhole knowing that we were going to have this conversation.
Oh, I should send you some shit. Like,
please.
I'll send you some stuff because there's a lot of information out there and it's hard to sift through.
So I can tell you where I've gotten to, like, I understand how it is formed, like how it was made, the man with the message board, the other man.
But do you understand the connection to gaming?
Yeah, the Gamergate stuff?
No. That the actual design of QAnon as a process is designed like Pokemon Go. It's an ARG.
Okay.
Right? So I have a friend called Jim Stewartson who's one of the people who helped design Pokemon Go.
Cool.
And he's become a huge anti-QAnon activist because he was watching QAnon work and he's like, I can see what they're doing. I helped invent this.
Right.
It's a game. It's a game of following clues. Now, when things are done legit and it's a commercial exercise or fun or whatever it is, they always put boundaries around the game. So, for instance, one of the things they learned really early on was that with like Pokemon Go, if you put a Pokemon in the middle of a freeway, someone's going to be out of their mind enough to just wander out into the freeway.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
So they realized you had to put boundaries around the game.
Yep.
And they put a lot of boundaries around these early ARGs, which were like, hey, when you see this, this kind of thing is a clue. This isn't. That's just part of regular life, right?
Yep.
But what QAnon does is it removes all of those boundaries. And it tells you, it doesn't only tell you those things aren't clues, it says everything's a clue.
Right. And so you've
that's
got to
how you drive people
guard.
Insane. That's yeah. how you drive people insane. They
because
become schizophrenics.
Vigilant. Yes.
And you know that experience you had? The reason you were questioning it about, was it a hummingbird or a bumblebee?
Bumblebee.
A bumblebee. The reason you were questioning it was you realized that you are entering the realm of madness.
Oh, yeah.
Where people find signs and connections in things that may not be there. And
right.
you, as much as you felt the spiritual experience in your heart, you were a little like, I don't know,
oh,
maybe
I had
this
no
happened,
idea.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Exactly. But that's because you've been trained to have like a healthy amount of skepticism about seeing signs all over the place.
Right.
If you're being inundated with information 24 hours a day that tells you, yeah, look for signs.
And
connect
give them
the
permission.
Dots.
Yeah.
Oh, connect the dots. It's all about the liberals who are running the show. It's all about they're trying to kidnap your kids. It's all about this. It's all about that. Can't you see? Can't you see the awakening? Like, you're driven insane. There's actually a word for it. I can't remember it. It's called like aprophenia or something. You can look it up. Maybe if you do any show notes under these, you can put that word there. But it's a word that schizophrenics have that means seeing connections where there aren't connections.
Yeah, fuck. I got to download Pokemon Go again by the sounds of things.
But so anyway, what's happened is that, and again, I don't want people to think I'm like some like hardcore Democrat or Labor Party guy, because honestly, I'm a lefty like in spirit.
Yeah.
But I'm like anti-politician in general. I mean, I see there's moments where we have to kind of use the political system to protect people and to get things done. But I don't have any agenda that I need to see like Democrats in power more than Republicans. But I do have an agenda in terms of when I see cult dynamics at work that are literally breaking people's free will by convincing them that they're finding free will.
Right.
They're all being woken up. It seduces people and they're being pulled into it thinking they're becoming free and they're becoming enslaved. And it's a bizarre phenomena to be witnessing.
So what I would like to do is for tomorrow, send me some links.
Put a pin in it.
Like send me some links and I want to have a look and see if I can expand my brain, because I feel like there's so much more obviously to unpack here, because it's connected to all of these other worlds
sure.
that you're involved in, and I want to know about that stuff. What we should do is, let's call it here, and then tomorrow we can come back and revisit.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you, Ben.
Sounds good, buddy. Talk to you tomorrow.
Ben Lee in Quarantine is a collaboration between me, Max Quinn, and Ben Lee. I'm doing all the mixing and producing and editing and stuff. Sorry if you run into any pops or clicks or bung audio. I'm trying. Thank you to Ben. You can find him on the internet at Ben Lee Music. You can say hi to me at Max Quinn. We'll have another episode for you real soon.